Municipal Employees, William Lucy Building, located at 6025 East Burnside in Portland, Oregon. Our next general membership meeting is June 12th, 2018, beginning at 6 p.m. Please join us. Our email address is orcbtu10, that's basically Oregon CBU10, cbtu10 at gmail.com. We would love to hear from you and have you join us in our evolving work representing black union workers in the Pacific Northwest. Thanks again for tuning in to our monthly segment of Labor Radio. We will be back with you the first Monday of July 2018 on KBOO.FM. Holla!
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present the live broadcast for the 26th annual Good in the Hood Multicultural Music, Arts, and Food Festival. This three-day celebration kicks off Friday, June 22nd, with the Good in the Hood Parade and Festival continuing Saturday, June 23rd, and ending Sunday evening, June 24th. Good in the Hood is back at King School Park at Northeast Grand Avenue. Tune into KBOO starting Saturday afternoon on June 23rd for the live broadcast. More information about Good in the Hood can be found on the KBOO.FM website on the home page.
Sometimes you see that I'm mad. Don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Ready to go.
Hi, welcome to KBOO Prison Pipeline with Emma Lugo co-hosting tonight, and joining me on the telephone is Paul Wright. And Paul, what exactly is your title?
I'm the executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. I'm also the editor of Prison Legal News, and I'm also the founder of the organization.
Great, and you're no stranger to KBOO.
No, I've been on your show a bunch of times. I think it's great that you guys have had such a commitment to covering prison and criminal justice issues over all these years, long before it was popular.
Yeah, we're, we try to cover all our bases, and that's part of why I have you on today, because we get your newsletter pretty regularly, which gives great information about what's going on in the criminal justice system, what's going on with the fight for the rights for prisoners, for people who were formerly incarcerated, and so it's the leading, I mean, for me, it's the first place I go when I'm looking for news and information about what's happening with criminal justice reform. And I thought that we could take a few minutes to talk about what's been happening lately, what are some trends, and where are positive things happening, where are we kind of sliding back, and, just kind of let people know the big picture. So,
sure.
Maybe we could start by just, what are some big issues that you're seeing going on right now with criminal justice reform, with the fight for prisoners' rights, for the formerly incarcerated?
Well, I'd say overall, I think as far as like a lot of the big reform is, not a lot's happening that's positive, in the sense of, for those of us that have been around for a while, when we saw the prison population double in the space of 10 years. It went from 1 million people locked up to 2 million people locked up between 1990 and 1998. Nothing similar, even remotely similar to that, is happening to push those numbers down. A lot of the negatives that we're seeing, I think, you know, and I think that's also one of the things, too, is I think sometimes people think that reform is all, that reform is positive, and I think that, unfortunately, not all reform is necessarily good. So I think some of the negatives that we're seeing is we're seeing the increased monetization of all contact between prisoners and their families. I think that's one of the things we've seen. It started out with the prison phone industry, where a couple of companies basically charged for exorbitant rates for telephone calls between prisoners and their family members and loved ones outside of prison. And we've seen that basically that has steadily increased and expanded into pretty much every realm of contact between prisoners and the outside world. Then that includes everything from video calling to money transfers, commissary operations. We're basically formerly free services are now monetized and charged for. And so I think that's been one of those reforms that basically it's happening one contract at a time at every jail and DOC around the country. I think that's something that we're just seeing more of.
Is that happening in state and federal prisons as well as for-profit prisons?
Yes, actually, it's the for-profit prisons actually have not been on the forefront of this. The government prisons have been in the vanguard of this, and so much of this is basically, it's also a kickback-based model where basically what these companies are doing is they're taking formerly free services like visitation, for example. The government didn't charge prisoners to or their families for a visit by family members. So now what they do is they eliminate in-person visitation. They call it video visitation, which we actually think video calling is probably a more appropriate term, and then they charge $1 or $2 a minute for that contact, which previously was free. So that's just one of the ways that this, you know, you see basically this monetization of human contact, and
how can policies like that be combated and revoked? What kind of work is going on to is there a way of pushing back against this monetization?
Sure, absolutely. And I think what's happened in a lot of places, I think Portland is one place where some of the contracts that we've gotten that the Human Rights Defense Center has obtained and we've publicized had provisions for like Securus and Global Tellink. These companies would require that prisons and jails signing these contracts for the video calling as part of the contract requirement, they agreed to eliminate in-person visitation. Because what these companies have found is that given a choice, prisoners and their families don't use these exorbitantly priced services, which are generally pretty low quality and crappy. And So they eliminate the free alternative and then force prisoners and their families to use the expensive, private company model. But in some cases, you know, communities have organized. They fought back against this. Multnomah County was in the process of doing this. There was community opposition, and they retreated. And at least on that. But the reality is the other 37 or 36 counties in Oregon haven't. And that's comes down to the thing of these companies and their government collaborators, they're able to push these policies through and these practices through. And even if 1% of the time they get some pushback and they go back a little bit on that, they still won 99% of the pie. So, yes, there has been pushback. There has been efforts to combat this. The Human Rights Defense Center, one of the things we've been doing is one of our priorities nationally has been attacking debit card practices where people are released from prison or jail, including after just being arrested and never actually entering the jail population. They have their cash money taken from them, and then they have debit cards foisted on them, which then charge them exorbitant fees to access their very own cash, the money they went into the jail with. So that's one of the things that we're doing, and in general, it's one of those things. You know, we've been doing that. We have litigation pending, including in Portland, Oregon, and we're waiting for decisions on some of these cases. So there are ways to fight back. There are ways to organize against this stuff. But I think the critical thing to remember is it's the government officials, the jail officials, the sheriffs, the prison officials at the DOC level that are making these decisions, that are entering into these contracts. And this stuff is happening with no type of legislative oversight, not that the legislature seemed to have problems with it. But, you know, it's happening one contract at a time, one facility at a time. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, they really don't have any type of organized opposition, certainly not at the national level.
Mm-hmm. It seems like what's needed is a set of rights that guarantees that families have access to people who are incarcerated, because that connection that happens between people who are on the inside and people on the outside is so vital to a successful reentry into the community after incarceration.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things is that, you know, but it also gets down, I think there's also like a very anti-democratic nature to these contracts as well. Plus, it's the other thing, too, is, you know, why do we have these government officials that are basically putting their own greed ahead of community safety, ahead of the well-being of their taxpayers and their constituents? Because I think it's important to note that, you know, there's no rule or law that says they have to enter into these kickback contracts and exploit prisoners and their families. Sadly, they just seem to do it on their own. And I think I'm only aware of, out of 3,200 sheriffs, I'm only aware of, I think, two around the country that don't take the kickbacks and aren't gouging the prisoners in their captivity, which I think is a pretty sad commentary on our elected officials.
So something that's been in the news a lot lately has been the attack on immigrant rights and what's been going on with ICE and with immigrant detentions. Can you talk a little bit about that, what you've been seeing?
Sure. I think one of the things to keep in mind is that immigrant detention has been pretty abysmal for decades. It wasn't like it was that good under Obama or Clinton. And so most of the immigration beds, around 75% of the capacity for caging immigrants, is in the hands of private prisoners. It's not the federal government that operates those prisons. And so basically, you know, we've seen those conditions. Generally, they tend to be fairly bad. And that has continued. You know, it's been pretty much a steady continuum for at least the last 30 years or so that I've been following these issues. And I think that what we see now is just, you know, more rhetoric, I think, emanating from the White House in terms of rounding up and caging immigrants. But I think some of the actual numbers, I was looking at those the other day, and it seems like some of the actual numbers are actually lower under Trump than they were under Obama.
Right, that's a popular misconception people have. They think that during the Obama era this wasn't an issue, but it was just as much of an issue as you just pointed out.
Well, I think in some respects it was more of an issue because Obama really earned the term deporter in chief. Far more people were deported under Obama than have been deported under Trump. So again, you know, we're not talking about anything new. Part of the other reality that I think that we've got is that I think under Obama conditions, detention conditions for immigration prisoners in both government prisons and private prisons were both very horrific and very bad. So in some respects, you know, that hasn't changed at all either. I think that one of the things is, as someone who's been doing criminal justice reform work for the past 30 years or so, somehow people think that who's in the White House makes a difference for prisoners. And I think it goes back to Frederick Douglass's comment about the 4th of July, that for a slave, the 4th of July means nothing. And I think that the reality is that for prisoners, it doesn't really matter who's in the White House. They're still subjected to horrific, terrible conditions. And that hasn't really changed regardless of who's in the White House. What's interesting is at least one of the things that Donald Trump has done as president, though, is he at least has said that prison reform as far as conditions is at least something he's willing to consider or talk about, which that's kind of unique for, you know, for presidents at the national level. No one likes to talk about prison conditions.
Well, I will hold my judgment until I see some expectations met and some actions taken. I'm not really excited about this white nationalist, you know, lightning rod who's basically used racism as a way of dividing the American people and gaining power. So to me, he's a fascist, but that's just how I see it. That's really off topic, so I'm sorry I went down that rabbit hole. But let's get back to prisoners.
With that. I'm just saying that in terms of, at least in terms of talking about prison reform, in a positive sense, that's kind of something new. So
that is different. Yeah,
and
yeah.
You know, it's like whatever. You know, I mean, pretty much Bill Clinton remains the worst thing that's happened in memory, mm-hmm. I think, probably in U.S. history to American prisoners. So, you know, so that's one legacy that exists.
A nightmare, yeah. Yeah, all the presidents have been nightmares. I mean, it's hard to understand how, you know, you could become the commander-in-chief of the United States and not make prison reform, like, your first priority. You know, that shows that you have no knowledge of what the criminal justice system really is, how it's really, you know.
Bill Clinton did, but it was all bad. I mean, mm-hmm. he made prison reform his top priority by enacting the Prison Litigation Reform Act, which eliminated, made it virtually impossible for prisoners to, to challenge and to successfully challenge their prison conditions. So, you know, he did that. He passed the 1994 crime bill, which eliminated education opportunities through the Pell Grants for prisoners. He forced, not forced, but he gave a lot of incentives to states to change their prison release policies. He enacted the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which largely foreclosed any type of federal court review of state convictions. I think Bill Clinton really made prison reform a priority of his presidency, and he put a lot of effort into making things a lot worse for people in prison.
Yeah.
So it has happened. It's just, and I think that's why I say is I think sometimes people have the idea that when you use the word reform, that it automatically means something progressive or good or desirable. And sadly, I'd say almost everything that's happened in the last 50 years in this country has been pretty negative. I think the closest thing that we've seen in probably the last 40 years that can be called even remotely positive as far as legislation for prisoners, at least at the federal level, was RLUIPA, the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, and the Prison Rape Elimination Act. And both of those were enacted under George Bush II's administration. And they were pretty tepid and watered down, but, you know.
Yeah, it's allowing people to practice their traditional religious practices more easily within the context of prison.
Right, which, of course, does nothing for atheists or actual conditions, but.
Right, yes, that wouldn't do me any good as an atheist, but.
Me neither.
Yeah. I just did a show last month talking about lack of access to health care in Oregon state prisons. Nationally, how are things moving along with access to health care for people who are incarcerated?
Frankly, let's just say that it's horrific. This is a national issue. We report nationally about prison medical issues and jail medical issues. And just at every level, it's really horrific in that prisoners generally do not receive even minimally adequate health care at any level, including dental, mental health care, as well as physical mental health care. I mean, you have, you know, we're just replete with instances where prisoners are dying of, you know, very simple, very simple, easily treatable illnesses, and basically they just don't get the treatment they need. And of course, you know, what's really pathetic about this, of course, is that if they were not in prison, they could at least show up in an emergency room and perhaps save their lives. But because they're held in cages, they're not able to do that. So literally, the government ensures that they die. And literally around the country, thousands of prisoners die every year, nearly all of them from medical neglect. And I think it's also one of the things that's important to note is that, you know, the reason people are dying is not because they have some exotic disease or, you know, something that top-notch doctors would be required to diagnose and treat. But no, people die of very simple things. You know, they're diabetics. They don't get insulin. They have hypertension. They don't get their medication. They have HIV or AIDS, and they don't get those medications. You know, it's real. Yeah. It really is. These really are policies of deliberate indifference, where it's like, yes, the government knows they have serious medical needs, and the government then decides to do nothing about them.
Here in Oregon, we had a woman died here in Oregon about 3 months ago of the flu, and she was someone who had been sentenced under Measure 11. She was a meth addict who got into a car accident on school grounds, and the person that she hit injured their arm. And so she was sentenced to, I think, 7 years or maybe 10 years in prison for this car accident. And within the first 3 months that she was in, she contracted the flu. She hadn't been given an opportunity to have a flu shot. You know, she wasn't really familiar with the system, and she died in prison, shackled to a bed, and her family wasn't notified until the last minute, and it was really sad. I mean, she was a grandmother, and it was, you know, a clear case of neglect.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, this is all too common, and also common is the fact that no one's going to be held accountable for her death. You know, no prison official or jail official is losing their job. No one's being questioned, okay, why did this woman die of something that was easily treatable and diagnosable? And I think that's kind of like, that's why I say is these problems are very, they're very systemic, and they're very systemic, and they're very, they almost define the American carceral experience, is that if you get sick, no one cares, and you're very likely to die from a condition that, is easily treatable and that everyone knows is easily treatable.
Mm-hmm. Looking ahead, is there anything that you see on the horizon that's positive, that gives you some hope for what's happening with work to abolish, reform prisons in a positive way?
Sure. Some of the stuff that's actually happening now is there's been efforts challenging the whole system of money bail, and I think that's a really encouraging note. Of course, you know, we haven't really seen how much of a fight back there's going to be from the bail industry and also the government officials that push for bail. But, you know, when you look at jail prisoners in particular, generally most people are held in pretrial detention because they're simply too poor to afford money bail. And so that's one of the issues that affect them. So, you know, so that's one of the things I think is very encouraging, that, you know, that conversation has even started. In some respects, though, I think that, it's one of the things that I think that's one thing that's positive. I think there's also efforts to combat this whole practice of caging people because they can't pay fines and stuff.
It's crazy. Yeah, sorry.
But, you know, but what I was going to say about that, though, is what's interesting is that in some respects, this is all a modern police state creation, is that 30 years ago, people weren't being fined. So in some respects, what passes as, I think, criminal justice reform, we're just trying to turn the clock back 10, 15, or 20 years before they were doing this. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not really trying to move the ball forward in terms of, mass decarceration or anything like that. It's, you know, it's very much a, you know, it's very much just trying to undo some of the more negative or some of the things around the edges of the mass incarceration state that we have to deal with.
Yeah,
and I think that one of the
these issues having to do with fines are part of the new Jim Crow. I mean, it's a way of controlling people of color and poor people, even if they're not within the confines of the criminal justice system specifically. It's a way of like keeping those populations in check. So that's good news.
Well, I think it goes beyond that, though. I think that one of the things that happens as well, I think that, yes, there's that aspect of it, but I also think that that some of the other aspects of it are that the ruling class has erected and built this massive police state, and they realize that it's expensive to run this massive police state. So what they're trying to do is shift the cost of the policing onto the backs of the police. Rather than having rich people pay more in taxes to pay for this police state, they want to put the burden of paying for that police state on the backs of the poor.
Mm-hmm. And that's part of why fines are so high. I mean, fines are crazy for the most simple offenses. And it seems like when I was a kid, I don't remember, you know, fines being nearly so high as they have become in the last
30
years.
Largely non-existent. I think that's the key thing, is that, you know, they were not a part of the, they weren't a part of the agenda.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't happening.
Wow. Well, there's a lot we could talk about, but unfortunately we only have 3 or 4 minutes left.
Okay.
Paul, can you tell me a little bit about the work that you do at the Human Rights Defense Center? What is your organization about? How did you get started, and how can people get in touch with you?
Sure. I started the organization in 1990 when I was in prison in Washington State, and we initially started publishing one magazine, Prison Legal News. We've since grown to, we publish Prison Legal News, which covers detention conditions and conditions of confinement. We also publish Criminal Legal News, which is a monthly magazine that reports on the police state, the surveillance state, and criminal law and procedure. We also publish and distribute books related to the criminal justice system, and we do litigation and advocacy on pretty much all aspects of the criminal justice system. We have done a lot of work around prison ecology, the intersection between mass incarceration and the environment. We have a Stop Prison Profiteering Project, where we seek to end the practice of financially exploiting prisoners and their families. As part of that, we have litigation pending in Oregon challenging the use of debit cards, where prisoners have their money taken from them when they're arrested, and then they're given debit cards and charge exorbitant fees to access their own money. We've done a lot of work around the exorbitant rates prisoners are charged for telephone calls. So that's just some of what we do. We also do wrongful death cases for victims that are killed by the police state, primarily in prisons and jails. So basically,
do you represent,
we do a lot of stuff.
Do you represent people who are killed by the police, not in like after they've entered the system, but at the beginning when, you know, for instance, when somebody is killed by the police during an arrest?
We haven't gotten there yet, and that's just a capacity issue on
mm-hmm.
our part.
Mm-hmm.
So we're hoping to build our capacity. But yeah, just in general, though, that's, you know, kind of what we do. And that said, we're regularly contacted by people in those situations, and we're usually able to refer them to folks in their jurisdiction who do those cases.
Well, kudos to you. It sounds like your work is so important. How can people get involved in work to reform in a positive way the criminal justice system, and how can they work with your organization if they want to get plugged in?
Sure. Well, the easiest thing is people can go to our website, either at Human Rights Defense Center or Prison Legal News or Criminal Legal News, and find out what's going on in their community, what's going on in their neck of the woods. And they can contact us through the websites. That's the easiest way. And I guess it depends on, you know, there's no shortage of things happening in everyone's community. Pretty much every county in America has a jail, and I'm willing to wager conditions are bad, and probably a lot of undesirable things are happening in those jails. So to say nothing of the state and federal prison systems. So those are all issues that people can get involved in. They're free to contact us as well. And we're also looking for support for our work. So even if people don't have the time to do it themselves, or they can make a donation to the Human Rights Defense Center, which they can find at humanrightsdefensecenter.org online. You know, that all goes towards helping the work that we're doing.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for your time, Paul. Just one last quick question. What do you think it's going to take to really turn things around in this country for the issue of criminal justice reform?
Probably a total social revolution.
Sounds good. I'm all for it. Thank you so much. We've been talking to Paul Wright with the Human Rights Defense Center and Prison Legal News. Paul, it's always great having you on KBOO. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Ready to go.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Village Building Convergence, taking place June 1st through 10th at locations all over Portland. The Village Building Convergence features over 30 community-built projects happening all over Portland, including the Mudbone Community Farm, Sherritt Square, and Portland University. Additionally, there are also ticketed evening events featuring speakers and local musicians. Again, that's the Village Building Convergence, taking place June 1st through 10th at locations all over Portland.